Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This evening, we present two short stories by Anton Chekhov, The Bet and The Lady with the Dog. Chekhov is perhaps most known for his plays, The Seagull, Uncle Vanya, The Three Sisters, The Cherry Orchard, but some consider Chekhov to be the founder of the modern short story. Ernest Hemingway declared The Lady with the Dog one of the greatest stories ever written. Here's what Virginia Woolf had to say about the unique quality of a Chekhov story. But is it the end, we ask? We have rather the feeling that we have overrun our signals, or it is as if a tune had stopped short without expected chords to close it. These stories are inconclusive, we say, and proceed to frame a criticism based upon the assumption that stories ought to conclude in a way that we recognize. In doing so, we raise the question of our own fitness as readers. Where the tune is unfamiliar and the end emphatic, lovers united, villains discomfited, intrigues exposed, as it is in most Victorian fiction, we can scarcely go wrong. But where the tune is unfamiliar and the end a note of interrogation, or merely the information that they went on talking, as it is in Chekhov, we need a daring and alert sense of literature to make us hear the tune, and in particular, those last notes which complete the harmony. And now, two stories by Anton Chekhov. The Lady with the Dog by Anton Chekhov. It was said that a new person had appeared on the seafront, a lady with a dog, Dmitri Dmitrich Gurov, who had by then been a fortnight at Yalta, and was so fairly at home there, had begun to take an interest in new arrivals. Sitting in Verney's pavilion, he saw walking on the seafront a fair-haired young lady of medium height, wearing a beret. A white Pomeranian dog was running behind her. And afterwards, he met her in the public gardens and in the square several times a day. She was walking alone, always wearing the same beret, and always with the same white dog. No one knew who she was, and everyone called her simply the lady with the dog. If she is here alone without a husband or friends, it wouldn't be amiss to make her acquaintance, Gurov reflected. He was under 40, but he had a daughter already 12 years old and two sons at school. He had been married young, when he was a student in his second year, and by now his wife seemed half as old again as he. She was a tall, erect woman with dark eyebrows, staid and dignified, and, as she said of herself, intellectual. She read a great deal, used phonetic spelling, called her husband not Dmitri, but Dimitri, and he secretly considered her unintelligent, narrow, inelegant, was afraid of her, and did not like to be at home. He had begun being unfaithful to her long ago, had been unfaithful to her often, and probably on that account almost always spoke ill of women, and when they were talked about in his presence, used to call them the lower race. It seemed to him that he had been so schooled by bitter experience that he might call them what he liked, and yet he could not get on for 2 days without the lower race. In the society of men, he was bored and not himself. With them, he was cold and uncommunicative. But when he was in the company of women, he felt free and knew what he wanted to say to them and how to behave, and he was at ease with them even when he was silent. In his appearance, in his character, in his whole nature, there was something attractive and elusive, which allured women and disposed them in his favor. He knew that, and some force seemed to draw him, too, to them. Experience often repeated, truly bitter experience, had taught him long ago that with decent people, especially Moscow people, always slow to move and irresolute, every intimacy, which at first so agreeably diversifies life and appears a light and charming adventure, inevitably grows into a regular problem of extreme intimacy, and in the long run the situation becomes unbearable. But at every fresh meeting with an interesting woman, This experience seemed to slip out of his memory, and he was eager for life, and everything seemed simple and amusing. One evening, he was dining in the gardens, and the lady in the beret came up slowly to take the next table. Her expression, her gait, her dress, and the way she did her hair told him that she was a lady, that she was married, that she was in Yalta for the first time and alone, and that she was dull there. The stories told of the immortality in such places as Yalta are to a great extent untrue. He despised them, and knew that such stories were for the most part made up by persons who would themselves have been glad to sin if they'd been able. But when the lady sat down at the next table, 3 paces from him, he remembered these tales of easy conquests, of trips to the mountains, and the tempting thought of a swift, fleeting love affair, a romance with an unknown woman whose name he did not know, suddenly took possession of him. He beckoned coaxingly to the Pomeranian, and when the dog came up to him, he shook his finger at it. The Pomeranian growled. Girov shook his finger at it again. The lady looked at him, and at once dropped her eyes. "He doesn't bite," she said, and blushed. "May I give him a bone?" he asked. And when she nodded, he asked courteously, "Have you been long in Yalta?"
5 days.
"And I have already dragged out a fortnight here." There was a brief silence.
"Time goes so fast, and yet it is so dull here," she said, not looking at him.
"Well, that's the fashion, to say it is dull here. A provincial will live in Belyov or Zidra and not be dull, and when he comes here, it's, oh, the dullness, oh, the dust. One would think he came from Granada."
She laughed. Then both continued eating in silence like strangers. But after dinner, they walked side by side. And there sprang up between them the light, jesting conversation of people who are free and satisfied, to whom it does not matter where they go or what they think about. They walked and talked of strange light on the sea. The water was a soft, warm lilac hue, and there was a golden streak from the moon upon it. They talked of how sultry it was after a hot day. And Girov learnt, too, that she was called Anna Sergeyevna. Afterwards, he thought about her in his hotel room. Thought she would certainly meet him the next day. It would be sure to happen. As he got into bed, he thought how lately she had been a girl at school, doing lessons like his own daughter. He recalled the diffidence, the angularity that was still manifest in her laugh and her manner of talking with a stranger. This must have been the first time in her life she had been alone, in surroundings in which she was followed, looked at, and spoken to merely from a secret motive which she could hardly fail to guess. He recalled her slender, delicate neck, her lovely gray eyes.
"Well, there's something pathetic about her anyway," he thought, and fell asleep.
A week had passed since they had made acquaintance. It was a holiday. It was sultry indoors, while in the street the wind whirled the dust round and round and blew people's hats off. It was a thirsty day, and Girov often went into the pavilion and pressed Anna Sergeyevna to have syrup and water or an ice. One did not know what to do with oneself. In the evening, when the wind had dropped a little, they went out on the dock to see the steamer come in. There were a great many people walking about the harbor. They had gathered to welcome someone, bringing bouquets, and 2 peculiarities of a well-dressed Yalta crowd were very conspicuous. The elderly ladies were dressed like young ones, and there were great numbers of generals. Owing to the roughness of the sea, the steamer arrived late, after the sun had set, and it was a long time turning about before it reached the dock. Anna Sergeyevna looked through her lorgnette at the steamer and the passengers, as though looking for acquaintances, and when she turned to Girov, her eyes were shining. She talked a great deal and asked disconnected questions, forgetting next moment what she had asked. Then she dropped her lorgnette in the crush. The festive crowd began to disperse. It was too dark to see people's faces. The wind had completely dropped, but Gurov and Anna Sergeyevna still stood as though waiting to see someone else come from the steamer. Anna Sergeyevna was silent now and sniffed the flowers without looking at Gurov.
"The weather is better this evening," he said. "Where shall we go now? Shall we drive somewhere?"
She made no answer. Then he looked at her intently, and all at once put his arm around her and kissed her on the lips, and breathed in the moisture and the fragrance of the flowers, and he immediately looked round him, anxiously, wondering whether anyone had seen them.
"Let us go to your hotel," he said softly,
and both walked quickly. The room was close and smelt of the scent she had bought at the Japanese shop. Gurov looked at her and thought, what different people one meets in the world. From the past, he preserved memories of careless, good-natured women who loved cheerfully and were grateful to him for the happiness he gave them, however brief it might be, and of women like his wife, who loved without any genuine feeling, with superfluous phrases, affected, hysterical, with an expression that suggested that it was not love nor passion, but something more significant, and of two or three others, very beautiful, cold women, on whose faces he had caught a glimpse of a rapacious expression, an obstinate desire to snatch from life more than it could give. And these were capricious, unreflected, domineering, unintelligent women, not in their first youth. And when Gurov grew cold to them, their beauty excited his hatred, and the lace on their linen seemed to him like scales. But in this case, there was still the diffidence, the angularity of inexperienced youth, an awkward feeling, and there was a sense of consternation as though someone had suddenly knocked on the door. The attitude of Anna Sergeyevna, the lady with the dog, to what had happened was somehow peculiar, very grave, as though it were her fall. So it seemed, and it was strange and inappropriate. Her face dropped and faded, and on both sides of it, her long hair hung down mournfully. She mused in a dejected attitude like the woman who was a sinner in an old-fashioned picture.
"It's wrong," she said. "You will be the first to despise me now."
There was a watermelon on the table. Gurov cut himself a slice and began eating it without haste. There followed at least half an hour of silence. Anna Sergeyevna was touching. There was about her the purity of a good, simple woman who had seen little of life. The solitary candle burning on the table threw a faint light on her face, yet it was clear that she was very unhappy.
"How could I despise you?" asked Gurov. "You don't know what you're saying."
"God forgive me," she said, and her eyes filled with tears. "It's awful."
"You seem to feel you need to be forgiven."
"Forgiven? No. I am a bad, low woman. I despise myself and don't attempt to justify myself. It's not my husband, but myself I have deceived. And not only just now, I have been deceiving myself for a long time. My husband may be a good, honest man, but he is a flunky. I don't know what he does there, what his work is, but I know he is a flunky. I was 20 when I married him. I have been tormented by curiosity. I wanted something better. There must be a different sort of life, I said to myself. I wanted to live, to live, to live. I was fired by curiosity. You don't understand it, but I swear to God, I could not control myself. Something happened to me. I could not be restrained. I told my husband I was ill and came here. And here I have been walking about as though I were dazed, like a mad creature. and now I have become a vulgar, contemptible woman whom anyone may despise."
Gurov felt bored already, listening to her. He was irritated by the naive tone, by this remorse, so unexpected and inopportune. But for the tears in her eyes, he might have thought she was jesting or playing a part. "I don't understand," he said softly. "What is it you want?" She hid her face in his breast and pressed close to him.
"Believe me, believe me, I beseech you," she said. "I love a pure, honest life, and sin is loathsome to me. I don't know what I'm doing. Simple people say the evil one has beguiled me, and I may say of myself now that the evil one has beguiled me."
"Hush, hush," he muttered. He looked at her fixed, scared eyes, kissed her, talked softly and affectionately, and by degrees she was comforted, and her gaiety returned. They both began laughing. Afterwards, when they went out, there was not a soul on the seafront. The town with its cypresses had quite a deathlike air, but the sea still broke noisily on the shore. A single barge was rocking on the waves, and a lantern was blinking sleepily on it. They found a cab and drove to Oreanda. "I found out your surname in the hall just now. It was written on the board." "Von Ditteritz," said Gurov. "Is your husband a German?"
"No, I believe his grandfather was a German, but he's an Orthodox Russian himself."
At Oreander they sat on a seat not far from the church, looked down at the sea, and were silent. Yalta was hardly visible through the morning mist. White clouds stood motionless on the mountain tops. The leaves did not stir on the trees. Grasshoppers chirruped, and the monotonous, hollow sound of the sea rising up from below spoke of peace, of the eternal sleep awaiting us. So it must have sounded when there was no Yalta, no Oreander here. So it sounds now, and it will sound as indifferently and monotonously when we are all no more. And in this constancy, in this complete indifference to the life and death of each of us, there lies hid, perhaps, a pledge of our eternal salvation, of the unceasing movement of life upon earth, of unceasing progress towards perfection. Sitting beside a young woman who in the dawn seemed so lovely, soothed and spellbound in these magical surroundings, the sea, mountains, clouds, the open sky, Gurov thought how in reality everything is beautiful in this world when one reflects. Everything except what we think or do ourselves when we forget our human dignity and the higher aims of our existence. A man walked up to them, probably a keeper, looked at them and walked away. And this detail seemed mysterious and beautiful too. They saw a steamer come from Theodosia, with its lights out in the glow of dawn. "There's dew on the grass," said Anna Sergeyevna after a silence.
"Yes, it's time to go home."
They went back to the town. Then they met every day at 12 o'clock on the seafront, lunched and dined together, went for walks, admired the sea. She complained that she slept badly, that her heart throbbed violently. Asked the same questions, troubled now by jealousy, and now by the fear that he did not respect her sufficiently. And often in the square or gardens, when there was no one near them, he suddenly drew her to him and kissed her passionately. Complete idleness, these kisses in broad daylight, while he looked round in dread of someone seeing them, the heat, the smell of the sea, and the continual passing to and fro before him of idle, well-dressed, well-fed people, made a new man of him. He told Anna Sergeyevna how beautiful she was, how fascinating. He was impatiently passionate. He would not move a step away from her, while she was often pensive and continually urged him to confess that he did not respect her, did not love her in the least, and thought of her as nothing but a common woman. Rather late, almost every evening, they drove somewhere out of town, to Orianda or the waterfall, and the expedition was always a success. The scenery invariably impressed them as grand and beautiful. They were expecting her husband to come, but a letter came from him saying that there was something wrong with his eyes, and he entreated his wife to come home as quickly as possible. Anna Sergeyevna made haste to go.
"It's a good thing I'm going away," she said to Girov. "It's the finger of destiny."
She went by coach, and he went with her. They were driving the whole day. When she had got into a compartment of the express, and when the second bell had rung, she said,
"Let me look at you once more. Look at you once again. That's right."
She did not shed tears, but was so sad that she seemed ill, and her face was quivering.
"I shall remember you, think of you," she said. "God be with you. Be happy. Don't remember evil against me. We are parting forever. It must be so, for we ought never to have met. Well, God be with you."
The train moved off rapidly. Its lights soon vanished from sight, and a minute later there was no sound of it, as though everything had conspired together to end as quickly as possible that sweet delirium, that madness. Left alone on the platform and gazing into the dark distance, Girov listened to the chirrup of the grasshoppers and the hum of the telegraph wires, feeling as though he had only just waked up. And he thought, musing, that there had been another episode or adventure in his life, and it too was at an end, and nothing was left of it but a memory. He was moved, sad, and conscious of a slight remorse. This young woman, whom he would never meet again, had not been happy with him. He was genuinely warm and affectionate with her, but yet in his manner, his tone, and his caresses, there had been a shade of irony, the coarse condensation of a happy man who was, besides, almost twice her age. All the time, she had called him kind, exceptional, lofty. Obviously, he had seemed to her different from what he really was. So he had unintentionally deceived her. Here at the station was already a scent of autumn. It was a cold evening. "It's time for me to go north," thought Girov as he left the platform. "High time." At home in Moscow, everything was in its winter routine. The stoves were heated, and in the morning it was still dark when the children were having breakfast and getting ready for school, and the nurse would light the lamp for a short time. The frosts had begun already. When the first snow has fallen on the first day of sledge driving, it is pleasant to see the white earth, the white roofs, to draw soft, delicious breath, and the season brings back the days of one's youth. The old limes and birches, white with hoarfrost, have a good-natured expression. They are nearer to one's heart than cypresses and palms, and near them one doesn't want to be thinking of the sea and the mountains. Girov was Moscow-born. He arrived in Moscow on a fine, frosty day, and when he put on his fur coat and warm gloves and walked along Petrovka, and when on Saturday evening he heard the ringing of the bells, his recent trip and the places he had seen lost all charm for him. Little by little he became absorbed in Moscow life, greedily reading 3 newspapers a day, and declared he did not read the Moscow papers on principle. He already felt a longing to go to restaurants, clubs, dinner parties, anniversary celebrations, and he felt flattered at entertaining distinguished lawyers and artists, and at playing cards with a professor at the doctor's club. He could already eat a whole plateful of salt fish and cabbage. In another month, he fancied the image of Anna Sergeyevna would be shrouded in a mist in his memory, and only from time to time would visit him in his dreams with a touching smile, as others did. But more than a month passed. Real winter had come, and everything was still clear in his memory, as though he had parted with Anna Sergeyevna only the day before, and his memories glowed more and more vividly. When in the evening stillness he heard from his study the voices of his children preparing their lessons, or when he listened to a song or the organ at the restaurant, or the storm howled in the chimney, suddenly everything would rise up in his memory. What had happened on the dock in the early morning with the mist on the mountains, and the steamer coming from Theodosia, and the kisses. He would pace a long time about his room, remembering it all and smiling. Then his memory passed into dreams, and in his fancy the past was mingled with what was to come. Anna Sergeyevna did not visit him in dreams, but followed him about everywhere like a shadow and haunted him. When he shut his eyes, he saw her as though she were living before him, and she seemed to him lovelier, younger, tenderer than she was, and he imagined himself finer than he had been in Yalta. Even the evenings she peeped out at him from bookcases, from the fireplace, from the corner. He heard her breathing, the caressing rustle of her dress. In the street, he watched the women looking for someone like her. He was tormented by an intense desire to confide his memories to someone, but in his home it was impossible to talk of his love, and he had no one outside. He could not talk to his tenants, nor to anyone at the bank. And what had he to talk of? Had he been in love, then? Had there been anything beautiful, poetical, or edifying, or simply interesting in his relations with Anna Sergeyevna? And there was nothing for him but to talk vaguely of love, of women, and no one guessed what it meant. Only his wife twitched her black eyebrow and said, "The part of the lady killer does not suit you at all, Dmitri." One evening, coming out of the doctor's club with an official with whom he had been playing cards, he could not resist saying, "If only you knew what a fascinating woman I made the acquaintance of in Yalta." The official got into his sledge and was driving away, but turned suddenly and shouted, "Dmitri Dmitrich!"
"What?" "You were right this evening. The sturgeon was a bit too strong."
These words, so ordinary, for some reason moved Gurov to indignation, and struck him as degrading and unclean. What savage manners, what people, what senseless nights, what uninteresting, uneventful days. The rage for card playing, the gluttony, the drunkenness, the continual talk always about the same thing, useless pursuits and conversations always about the same things, absorbed the better part of one's time, the better part of one's strength. And in the end, there is left a life groveling and curtailed, worthless and trivial, and there is no escaping or getting away from it, just as though one were in a madhouse or a prison. Kirov did not sleep all night. He was filled with indignation, and he had a headache all the next day. And the next night he slept badly. He sat up in bed, thinking, or paced up and down in his room. He was sick of his children, sick of the bank. He had no desire to go anywhere or to talk of anything. In the holidays in December, he prepared for a journey and told his wife he was going to Petersburg to do something in the interests of a young friend, and he set off for Sarajevo. What for? He did not very well know himself. He wanted to see Anna Sergeyevna and talk with her, to arrange a meeting if possible. He reached Sarajevo in the morning and took the best room at the hotel, in which the floor was covered with gray army cloth, and on the table was an inkstand, gray with dust, and adorned with a figure on horseback, with its hat in its hand, and its head broke off. The hotel porter gave him the necessary information. Von Dietrich lived in a house of his own in Old Koncharny Street. It was not far from the hotel. He was rich and lived in good style and had his own horses. Everyone in the town knew him. The porter pronounced the name Dritteritz. Gurov went without haste to Old Koncharny Street and found the house. Just opposite the house stretched a long gray fence adorned with nails.
"One would run away from a fence like that,"
thought Gurov, looking from the fence to the windows of the house and back again. He considered. Today was a holiday, and the husband would probably be home. And in any case, it would be tactless to go to the house and upset her. If he were to send a note, it might fall into the husband's hands, and then it might ruin everything. The best thing was to trust to chance, and he kept walking up and down the street by the fence, waiting for the chance. He saw a beggar go into the gate and dogs fly at him. Then an hour later he heard a piano, and the sounds were faint and indistinct. Probably it was Anna Sergeyevna playing. The front door suddenly opened, and an old woman came out, followed by the familiar white Pomeranian. Gurov was on the point of calling to the dog, but his heart began to beat violently, and in his excitement he could not remember the dog's name. He walked up and down and loathed the gray fence more and more, and by now he thought irritably that Anna Sergeyevna had forgotten him and was perhaps already amusing herself with someone else, and that that was very natural in a young woman who had nothing to look at from morning till night but that confounded fence. He went back to his hotel room and sat for a long while on the sofa, not knowing what to do. Then he had dinner and a long nap. How stupid and worrying it is, he thought when he woke and looked at the dark windows. It was already evening. Here I've had a good sleep for some reason. What shall I do in the night? He sat on the bed, which was covered by a cheap gray blanket, such as one sees in hospitals, and he taunted himself in his vexation. So much for the lady with the dog, so much for the adventure. You're in a nice fix. That morning at the station, a poster in large letters had caught his eye. The geisha was to be performed for the first time. He thought of this and went to the theater. It's quite possible she may go to the first performance, he thought. The theater was full. As in all provincial theaters, there was a fog above the chandelier. The gallery was noisy and restless. In the front row, the local dandies were standing up before the beginning of the performance with their hands behind them. In the governor's box, the governor's daughter, wearing a boa, was sitting in the front seat, while the governor himself lurked modestly behind the curtain, with only his hands visible. The orchestra was a long time tuning up. The stage curtain swayed. All the time the audience were coming in and taking their seats, Gurov looked at them eagerly. Anna Sergeyevna, too, came in. She sat down in the third row, and when Gurov looked at her, his heart contracted, and he understood clearly that for him there was in the whole world no creature so near, so precious, and so important to him. She, this little woman, in no way remarkable, lost in a provincial crowd, with a vulgar lorgnette in her hand. Filled his whole life now, was his sorrow and his joy, the one happiness that he now desired for himself, and to the sounds of the inferior orchestra, of the wretched provincial violins, he thought how lovely she was. He thought and dreamed. A young man with small side whiskers, tall and stooping, came in with Anna Sergeyevna and sat down beside her. He bent his head at every step and seemed to be continually bowing. Most likely this was the husband whom at Yalta, in a rush of bitter feeling, she had called a flunky. And there really was in his long figure, his side whiskers and the small bald patch on his head, something of the flunky's obsequiousness. His smile was sugary, and in his buttonhole there was some badge of distinction, like the number on a waiter. During the first interval, the husband went away to smoke. She remained alone in her stall. Gurov, who was sitting in the stalls too, went up to her and said in a trembling voice with a forced smile, "Good evening." She glanced at him and turned pale, then glanced again with horror, unable to believe her eyes, and tightly gripped the fan and the lorgnette in her hands, evidently struggling with herself not to faint. Both were silent.
She was sitting, he was standing, frightened by her confusion and not venturing to sit down beside her. The violins and the flute began tuning up. He felt suddenly frightened. It seemed as though all the people in the boxes were looking at them. She got up and went quickly to the door. He followed her, and both walked senselessly along passages and up and down stairs, and figures in legal, scholastic, and civil service uniforms, all wearing badges, flitted before their eyes. They caught glimpses of ladies, of fur coats hanging on pegs. The drafts blew on them, bringing a smell of stale tobacco. And Gurov, whose heart was beating violently, thought, "Oh, heavens, why are these people here, and this orchestra?" And at that instant, he recalled how when he had seen Anna Sergeyevna off at the station, he had thought that everything was over and they would never meet again. But how far they were still from the end. On the narrow, gloomy staircase over which was written, "To the amphitheater," she stopped. "How you have frightened me," she said, breathing hard, still pale and overwhelmed. "Oh, how you have frightened me! I'm half dead! Why have you come? Why?" "But do understand, Anna, do understand," he said hastily in a low voice. "I entreat you to understand." She looked at him with dread, with entreaty, with love. She looked at him intently to keep his features more distinctly in her memory. "I am so unhappy," she went on, not heeding him. "I have thought of nothing but you all the time. I live only in the thought of you. And I wanted to forget you. But why, oh, why have you come?" On the landing above them, two schoolboys were smoking and looking down. But that was nothing to Gurov. He drew Anna Sergeyevna to him and began kissing her face, her cheeks, her hands. "What are you doing? What are you doing?" she cried in horror, pushing him away. "We are mad. Go away today. Go away at once. I beseech you by all that is sacred. I implore you. There are people coming this way." Someone was coming up the stairs. "You must go away," Anna Sergeyevna went on in a whisper. "Do you hear, Dmitri Dmitrich? I will come and see you in Moscow. I have never been happy. I am miserable now. And I never, never shall be happy, never. Don't make me suffer still more. I swear I'll come to Moscow. But now let us part. My precious, good, dear one, we must part." She pressed his hand and began rapidly going downstairs, looking round at him, and from her eyes he could see that she really was unhappy. Gurov stood for a little while, listened, then, when all sound had died away, he found his coat and left the theater. And Anna Sergeyevna began coming to see him in Moscow. Once in 2 or 3 months, she left Sarajevo telling her husband that she was going to consult a doctor about an internal complaint, and her husband believed her, and he did not believe her. In Moscow, she stayed at the Slavyansky Bazaar Hotel and at once sent a man in a red cap to Gurov. Gurov went to see her, and no one in Moscow knew of it. Once he was going to see her in this way on a winter morning. The messenger had come the evening before when he was out. With him walked his daughter, whom he wanted to take to school. It was on the way. Snow was falling in big, wet flakes.
"It's 3 degrees above freezing point, and yet it is snowing," said Gurov to his daughter. "The thaw is only on the surface of the earth. There's quite a different temperature at a greater height in the atmosphere."
"And why are there no thunderstorms in the winter, father?"
He explained that, too. He talked, thinking all the while that he was going to see her. And no living soul knew of it, and probably never would know. He had 2 lives, one open, seen, and known by all who cared to know, full of relative truth and of relative falsehood, exactly like the lives of his friends and acquaintances, and another life, running its course in secret. And through some strange, perhaps accidental, conjunction of circumstances, everything that was essential, of interest, and of value to him, everything in which he was sincere and did not deceive himself, everything that made the kernel of his life, was hidden from other people. And all that was false in him, the sheath in which he hid himself to conceal the truth, such, for instance, his work in the bank, his discussions at the club, his lower race, his presence with his wife at anniversary festivities, all that was open. And he judged of others by himself, not believing in what he saw, and always believing that every man had his real, most interesting life under the cover of secrecy and under the cover of night. All personal life rested on secrecy, and possibly it was partly on that account that civilized man was so nervously anxious that personal privacy should be respected. After leaving his daughter at school, Girov went on to the Slavyansky Bazaar. He took off his fur coat below, went upstairs, and softly knocked at the door. Anna Sergeyevna, wearing his favorite gray dress, exhausted by the journey and the suspense, had been expecting him since the evening before. She was pale. She looked at him and did not smile. And he had hardly come in when she fell on his breast. Their kiss was slow and prolonged, as though they had not met for 2 years.
"Well, how are you getting on there?" he asked. "What news?"
"Wait, I'll tell you directly. I can't talk."
She could not speak. She was crying. She turned away from him and pressed her handkerchief to her eyes.
"Let her have her cry out. I'll sit down and wait," he thought. And he sat down in an armchair.
Then he rang and asked for tea to be brought him, and while he drank his tea, she remained standing at the window with her back to him. She was crying from emotion, from the miserable consciousness that their life was so hard for them, that they could only meet in secret, hiding themselves from people like thieves. Was not their life shattered?
"Come, do stop," he said.
It was evident to him that this love of theirs would not soon be over, that he could not see the end of it. Anna Sergeyevna grew more and more attached to him. She adored him, and it was unthinkable to say to her that it was bound to have an end some day. Besides, she would not believe it. He went up to her and took her by the shoulders to say something affectionate and cheering, and at that moment he saw himself in the looking-glass. His hair was already beginning to turn gray, and it seemed strange to him that he had grown so much older, so much plainer during the last few years. The shoulders on which his hands rested were warm and quivering. He felt compassion for this life, still so warm and lovely, but probably already not far from beginning to fade and wither like his own. Why did she love him so much? He always seemed to women different from what he was, and they loved in him not himself, but the man created by their imagination, whom they had been eagerly seeking all their lives. And afterwards, when they noticed their mistake, they loved him all the same. And not one of them had been happy with him. Time passed, he had made their acquaintance, got on with them, parted. But he had never once loved. It was anything you like, but not love. And only now, when his head was gray, he had fallen properly, really in love, for the first time in his life. Anna Sergeyevna and he loved each other, like people very close and akin, like husband and wife, like tender friends. It seemed to them that fate itself had meant them for one another, and they could not understand why he had a wife and she had a husband. And it was as though they were a pair of birds of passage caught and forced to live in different cages. They forgave each other for what they were ashamed of in their past. They forgave everything in the present and felt that this love of theirs had changed them both. In moments of depression in the past, he had comforted himself with any arguments that came into his mind. But now he no longer cared for arguments. He felt profound compassion.
He wanted to be sincere and tender.
"Don't cry, my darling," he said. "You've had your cry. That's enough. Let us talk now. Let us think of some plan."
Then they spent a long while taking counsel together, talked of how to avoid the necessity for secrecy, for deception, for living in different towns and not seeing each other for a long time. How could they be free from this intolerable bondage?
"How? How?" he asked, clutching his head. "How?"
And it seemed as though in a little while the solution would be found. And then a new and splendid life would begin. And it was clear to both of them that they had still a long, long road before them, and that the most complicated and difficult part of it was only just beginning.
The Bet by Anton Chekhov. It was a dark autumn night. The banker was pacing from corner to corner of his study, recalling to his mind the party he gave in the autumn 15 years before. There were many clever people at the party and much interesting conversation. They talked, among other things, of capital punishment. The guests, among them not a few scholars and journalists, for the most part disapproved of capital punishment. They found it obsolete as a means of punishment, unfitted to Christian state and immortal. Some of them thought that capital punishment should be replaced universally by life imprisonment.
"I don't agree with you," said the host. "I myself have experienced neither capital punishment nor life imprisonment. But if one may judge a priori, then, in my opinion, capital punishment is more moral and more humane than imprisonment. Execution kills instantly. Life imprisonment kills by degrees. Who is the more humane executioner, one who kills you in a few seconds, or one who draws the life out of you incessantly for years?"
"They are both equally immoral," remarked one of the guests, "because their purpose is the same, to take away life. The state is not God. It has no right to take away that which it cannot give back if it should so desire."
Among the company was a lawyer, a young man of about 25. On being asked his opinion, he said,
"Capital punishment and life imprisonment are equally immoral. But if I were offered the choice between them, I would certainly choose the second. It's better to live somehow than not to live at all."
There ensued a lively discussion. The banker, who was then younger and more nervous, suddenly lost his temper, banged his fist on the table, and turning to the young lawyer, cried out,
"It's a lie! I bet you 2 million you wouldn't stick in a cell for 5 years.
"If you mean it seriously," replied the lawyer, "then I bet I'll stay not 5, but 15.
15! Done!" cried the banker.
"Gentlemen, I stake 2 million.
"Agreed. You stake 2 million, I my freedom," said the lawyer.
So this wild, ridiculous bet came to pass. The banker, who at that time had too many millions to count, spoiled and capricious, was beside himself with rapture. During supper, he said to the lawyer jokingly,
"Come to your senses, young roan, before it's too late. 2 millions are nothing to me, but you stand to lose 3 or 4 of the best years of your life. I say 3 or 4 because you'll never stick it out any longer. Don't forget, either, you unhappy man, that voluntary is much heavier than enforced imprisonment. The idea that you have the right to free yourself at any moment will poison the whole of your life in the cell. I pity you."
And now the banker, pacing from corner to corner, recalled all this and asked himself,
"Why did I make this bet? What's the good? The lawyer loses 15 years of his life, and I throw away 2 million. Will it convince people that capital punishment is worse or better than imprisonment for life? No. No, all stuff and rubbish. On my part, it was the caprice of a well-fed man. On the lawyer's, pure greed of gold."
He recollected further what happened after the evening party.
It was decided that the lawyer must undergo his imprisonment under the strictest observation in a garden wing of the banker's house. It was agreed that during the period he would be deprived of the right to cross the threshold, to see living people, to hear human voices, and to receive letters and newspapers. He was permitted to have a musical instrument, to read books, to write letters, to drink wine and smoke tobacco. By the agreement, he could communicate, but only in silence, with the outside world through a little window specially constructed for this purpose. Everything necessary, books, music, wine, he could receive in any quantity by sending a note through the window. The agreement provided for all the minutest details, which made the confinement strictly solitary, and it obliged the lawyer to remain exactly 15 years, from 12 o'clock of November 14th, 1870, to 12 o'clock on November 14th, 1885. The least attempt on his part to violate the conditions, to escape, if only for 2 minutes before the time, freed the banker from the obligation to pay him the 2 million. During the first year of imprisonment, the lawyer, as far as it was possible to judge from his short notes, suffered terribly from loneliness and boredom. From his wing, day and night, came the sound of the piano. He rejected wine and tobacco. Wine, he wrote, excites desires, and desires are the chief foes of prisoner. Besides, nothing is more boring than to drink good wine alone, and tobacco spoils the air in his room. During the first year, the lawyer was sent books of a light character, novels with a complicated love interest, stories of crime and fancy, comedies, and so on. In the second year, the piano was heard no longer, and the lawyer asked only for classics. In the fifth year, music was heard again, and the prisoner asked for wine. Those who watched him said that during the whole of that year he was only eating, drinking, and lying on his bed. He yawned often and talked angrily to himself. Books he did not read. Sometimes at night he would sit down to write. He would write for a long time and tear it all up in the morning. More than once, he was heard to weep. In the second half of the sixth year, the prisoner began zealously to study languages, philosophy, and history. He fell on these subjects so hungrily that the banker hardly had time to get books enough for him. In the space of 4 years, about 600 volumes were brought at his request. It was while that passion lasted that the banker received the following letter from the prisoner. "My dear jailer, I am writing these lines in 6 languages. Show them to experts. Let them read them. If they do not find one single mistake, I beg you to give orders to have a gun fired off in the garden. By the noise, I shall know that my efforts have not been in vain. The geniuses of all ages and countries speak in different languages, but in them all burns the same flame. Oh, if you knew my heavenly happiness now that I can understand them." The prisoner's desire was fulfilled. 2 shots were fired in the garden by the banker's order. Later on, after the 10th year, the lawyer sat immovable before his table and read only the New Testament. The banker found it strange that a man who in 4 years had mastered 600 erudite volumes should have spent nearly a year in reading one book, easy to understand and by no means thick. The New Testament was then replaced by the History of Religions and Theology. During the last 2 years of his confinement, the prisoner read an extraordinary amount, quite haphazard. Now he would apply himself to the natural sciences. Then he would read Byron or Shakespeare. Notes used to come from him in which he asked to be sent at the same time a book on chemistry, a textbook of medicine, a novel, and some treatise on the philosophy or theology. He read as though he were swimming in the sea among broken pieces of wreckage, and in his desire to save his life was eagerly grasping one piece after another. The banker recalled all this and thought, "Tomorrow at 12 o'clock he receives his freedom. Under the agreement I shall have to pay him 2 million. If I pay, it's all over with me. I am ruined forever." 15 years before, he had had too many millions to count, but now he was afraid to ask himself which he had more of, money
or debts. Gambling on the stock exchange, risky speculation, and the recklessness of which he could not rid himself even in old age, had gradually brought his business to decay, and the fearless, self-confident, proud man of business had become an ordinary banker, trembling at every rise and fall in the market.
"That cursed bet," murmured the old man, clutching his head in despair. "Why didn't the man die? He's only 40 years old. He will take away my last farthing. Marry, enjoy life, gamble on the exchange, and I will look like an envious beggar and hear the same words from him every day. I'm obliged to you for the happiness of my life. Let me help you."
"No, it's too much. The only escape from bankruptcy and disgrace is that the man should die."
The clock had just struck 3. The banker was listening. In the house, everyone was asleep, and one could hear only the frozen trees whining outside the windows. Trying to make no sound, he took out of his safe the key of the door which had not been opened for 15 years, put on his overcoat, and went out of the house. The garden was dark and cold. It was raining. A damp, penetrating wind howled in the garden and gave the trees no rest. Though he strained his eyes, the banker could see neither the ground, nor the white statues, nor the garden wing, nor the trees. Approaching the garden wing, he called the watchman twice. There was no answer. Evidently, the watchman had taken shelter from the bad weather and now was asleep somewhere in the kitchen or the greenhouse.
"If I have the courage to fulfill my intention," thought the old man, "the suspicion will fall on the watchman first of all."
In the darkness, he groped for the steps and the door and entered the hall of the garden wing, then poked his way into a narrow passage and struck a match. Not a soul was there. Someone's bed, with no bedclothes on it, stood there, and an iron stove loomed in the dark corner. The seals on the door that led into the prisoner's room were unbroken. When the match went out, the old man, trembling from agitation, peeped into the little window. In the prisoner's room, a candle was burning dimly. The prisoner himself sat by the table. Only his back, the hair on his head, and his hands were visible. Open books were strewn about on the table, the two chairs, and on the carpet near the table. 5 minutes passed, and the prisoner never once stirred. 15 years' confinement had taught him to sit motionless. The banker tapped on the window with his finger, but the prisoner made no movement in reply. Then the banker cautiously tore the seals from the door and put the key into the lock. The rusty lock gave a hoarse groan, and the door creaked. The banker expected instantly to hear a cry of surprise and the sound of steps. 3 minutes passed, and it was as quiet inside as it had been before. He made up his mind to enter. Before the table sat a man, unlike an ordinary human being. It was a skeleton with tight, drawn skin, with long, curly hair like a woman's, and a shaggy beard. The color of his face was yellow, of an earthy shade. The cheeks were sunken, the back long and narrow, and the hand upon which he leaned his hairy head was so lean and skinny that it was painful to look upon. His hair was already silvering with gray, and no one who glanced at the senile emaciation of the face would have believed that he was only 40 years old. On the table before his bended head lay a sheet of paper on which something was written in a tiny hand.
"Poor devil," thought the banker. "He's asleep and probably seeing millions in his dreams. I have only to take and throw this half-dead thing on the bed, smother him a moment with a pillow, and the most careful examination will find no trace of a natural death. But first, let's read what he has written here."
The banker took the sheet from the table and read. "Tomorrow, at 12:00 midnight, I shall obtain my freedom and the right to mix with people. Before I leave this room and see the sun, I think it necessary to say a few words to you. On my own clear conscience and before God who sees me, I declare to you that I despise freedom,
life, health, and all that your books call the blessings of the world. For 15 years I have diligently studied earthly life. True, I saw neither the earth nor the people, but in your books I drank fragrant wine, sang songs, hunted deer and wild boar in the forest, loved women, and beautiful women, like clouds ethereal, created by the magic of your poet's genius, visited me by night and whispered to me wonderful tales, which made my head drunken. In your books I climbed the summit of Elbruz and Mount Blanc, and saw from there how the sun rose in the morning, and in the evening suffused the sky, the ocean, and lie mountain ridges with a purple gold. I saw from there how above me lightnings glimmered, cleaving the clouds. I saw green forests, fields, rivers, lakes, cities. I heard sirens singing and the playing of the pipes of Pan. I touched the wings of beautiful devils who came flying to me to speak of God. In your books I cast myself into bottomless abysses, worked miracles, burned cities to the ground, preached new religions, conquered whole countries. Your books gave me wisdom. All that wearying human thought created in the centuries is compressed to a little lump in my skull. I know that I am cleverer than you all. And I despise your books, despise all worldly blessings and wisdom. Everything is void, frail, visionary, and delusive as a mirage. Though you be proud and wise and beautiful, yet will death wipe you from the face of the earth like the mice underground. And your posterity, your history, and the immortality of your men of genius will be as frozen slag, burnt down together with the terrestrial globe. You are mad and gone the wrong way. You take falsehood for truth and ugliness for beauty. You would marvel if suddenly apple and orange trees should bear frogs and lizards instead of fruit, and if roses should begin to breathe the odor of a sweating horse. So do I marvel at you, who have bartered heaven for earth. I do not want to understand you. That I may show you indeed my contempt for that which you live, I waive the 2 million of which I once dreamed as of paradise, which I now despise. That I may deprive myself of my right to them, I shall come out from here 5 minutes before the stipulated term, and thus shall violate the agreement. When he had read, the banker put the sheet on the table, kissed the head of the strange man, and began to weep. He went out of the wing. Never at any other time, not even after his terrible losses on the exchange, had he felt such contempt for himself as now. Coming home, he lay down on his bed, but agitation and tears kept him a long time from sleeping. The next morning, the poor watchman came running to him and told him that they had seen the man who lived in the wing climb through the window into the garden. He had gone to the gate and disappeared. The banker instantly went with his servants to the wing and established the escape of the prisoner. To avoid unnecessary rumors, he took the paper with the renunciation from the table and, on his return, locked it in his safe. That's our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed our two stories by Anton Chekhov. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.